and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's tearing up of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which in effect hands China a great victory, making its alternative, the 16-nation Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the only game in town, thus empowering China to write its own rules going forward, the very criticism that Trump leveled at China during his campaign. Alfred McCoy, chair of history at the University of Wisconsin and the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, joins us to discuss how Trump is weakening America at warp speed by undoing the architecture of America's global strategic and economic power built up over decades. Added to which, as Trump hands over the Asia-Pacific to China, he is threatening to abandon NATO and is encouraging the breakup of Europe, which in turn hands victories beyond Putin's wildest dreams to Trump's favorite autocrat in the Kremlin. Then we'll examine the possible subtext in today's hearing to confirm Congressman Pompeo as the next head of the CIA, following the nomination of another partisan politician to become the Director of National Intelligence. A longtime senior staffer on the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees, Locke Johnson, the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia and author of The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War, joins us. We will discuss whether the counterintelligence investigation into possible ties between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin can be stopped by Trump's political appointees, and if the intelligence community will still be able to speak truth to power. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University and co-editor of Dissent magazine. He joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Trump's Civil Religion Has an Angry God, and whether Saturday's massive demonstrations against Trump could evolve into a Tea Party of the left that could influence the Democratic Party as the Tea Party has intimidated the GOP, as well as how lessons in Kazin's new book, War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1980, apply to today's demonstrations. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of The Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and the author of Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. And he's a regular at Tom Dispatch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Ian, lovely to be back again.
So, Al, when we spoke before, you explained what the real agenda of President Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact was, that it was more of a geostrategic agenda, not so much a trade pact. It was organizing the neighborhood, if you will, not just to contain China, but to also force China to play by the rules, which is the very thing that Trump has been campaigning about, saying that China doesn't play by the rules. Well, now Trump has handed China an amazing gift. It's absolutely breathtaking that now China's 16-nation regional comprehensive economic partnership has a clear path, and already people in the neighborhood that had wanted to be a part of the TPP are now going to sign on. And the RCP, as it's called, comprises the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and the six countries, Australia, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand. Already Singapore's prime minister, a big TPP supporter, is saying that they're going to join the RCEP along with Vietnam and Malaysia. And, of course, Australia and Japan will probably join them, although Japan is still holding out. And Abe's trying to make, you know, beat some sense into Trump's head, but I don't know that that's even possible. I've never seen anything like this. This America's shooting itself in the foot in an amazing way.
And all that is true. Words out of my own mouth, if you will. But it's actually broader and bolder than even that. That's just, if you will, one piece of the larger geopolitical puzzle. For 70 years, the United States has been the world's preeminent power. For the last quarter century, we've been supposedly the world's sole superpower. And the architecture of American power is a fairly simple one, but it's one that eludes most people, except, you know, geopolitical specialists, strategists in Washington, D.C., whose job it is to mine these things. And the architecture of power is very simple. First of all, at the end of World War II, we captured the axial ends, if you will, the choke points at the ends of the Eurasian landmass. We occupied Germany. Then in 1949, we set up the critical North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the NATO Alliance. That's now, I think, about 27 nations, one of the most durable alliances in the history of the world. And at the opposite end of the Eurasian landmass, beginning in 1951, we signed three bilateral pacts with the nations that form the island chain off the edge of Asia: the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, the Philippine Mutual Defense Treaty, and the ANZUS Agreement, the Australian-New Zealand-U.S. Agreement. And then we stitched together, if you will, a series of alliances, NATO all the way to CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and then those three pacts. And then we rimmed the Eurasian landmass with three fleets, the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, the 5th Fleet in the South China Sea base in the Philippines, the 7th Fleet in the South China Sea in the Philippines, and then finally the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf. And then most recently, since about 2010, we've built a string of 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily to Anderson Air Base in Guam. And the whole point of this massive array of diplomatic and military power has been to contain China and Russia inside the Eurasian landmass and give the United States the control over this strategic core of the world's geography and population. And Trump seems to be set out, it's almost bizarre, in a campaign to break up every single basis of the U.S. power that's been built up over the past 70 years. A couple of days ago, he branded, in an interview with a German newspaper, he branded NATO obsolete. And this is not the first time he said it. He reiterated, he's made it very clear that NATO's a very low priority. Historically, another basis of U.S. power was the special relationship with the United Kingdom. One of the first phone calls, if not the first phone call between any president-elect, was always with the British Prime Minister. Well, in this case, Trump met with Nigel Farage, the head of the UK Independence Party, and had a brief, very late, 10-minute conversation with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Another basis of U.S. geopolitical power has been the whole idea of an open world economy, a global economy, which the United States, by signing all kinds of trade agreements, beginning with the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs right after World War II, all the way through the World Trade Organization, and a whole series of multilateral and bilateral pacts, the United States has been very adept in negotiating trade agreements that steer the world's trade to the United States. And that was the design of the TPP. It was a rather clever strategy by President Obama. He knew that what China was doing was they had spent $1 trillion in laying down a massive infrastructure of railroads and most particularly oil and gas pipelines to turn the vast Eurasian landmass into, for the first time in human history, a unified continent, with those resources coming out of Central Asia and Siberia into China and fueling the rise of China as a major global power. And then China set up the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank. They got 57 members, including some of our closest allies, in order to counter the World Bank, which has been historically U.S. dominated. So what Obama had as a kind of counter strategy was two very large trade pacts: the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership of 12 nations, which had about 40% of world trade, and then another one called the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that was going to capture that another 20% of world trade from the European Union. Together, this would kind of drain the Eurasian landmass trade, its real economic lifeblood, away from Asia, away from China, towards the United States. The TTIP across the Atlantic to America, the TTP across the Pacific to America. It was a brilliant strategy with profound geopolitical implications. Well, Trump is not only trash, he just announced it today. The TTP is dead. Well, the TTIP died a few months ago because of the rise of populism in Europe. And now NAFTA's on the table. You know, the European Union has weakened. NATO's proclaimed obsolete. So almost every single critical piece in the geopolitical structure that the United States built to exercise hegemony, world power, world leadership, call it what you will, over the past 70 years is being willfully, systematically demolished. It's an extraordinary historical moment. And I think that's why the German foreign minister two days ago, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, proclaimed that the 20th century is finally, the world order of the 20th century is finally over, he said, and we don't know what the shape of the new world order is going to be. So it's an historic moment. Not necessarily a great one, but it's certainly an important moment.
Now, of course, at today's press briefing by the new Trump press secretary, Sean Spicer, the NPR correspondent Mara Liasson asked Spicer, well, how come you're handing to China its regional comprehensive economic partnership, this massive victory with all of these countries that would have been in the TPP now will join in with China? So you've basically handed China a gift. And Sean Spicer just spoke absolute gibberish. He clearly doesn't know what he's talking about, neither does his boss. So what can you figure out here? I mean, is Trump just basically just this dangerous idiot? He may well be Putin's puppet. We know that is a real possibility. But I don't understand it. Is it just because Obama did it, I'm going to tear it down? I mean, is there anybody that can talk sense into this guy?
Well, first of all, he has surrounded himself with a couple of top military people. The Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, was the former head of Central Command. He was regarded at the time as a bit extreme on Iran and all that, but he's a career, seasoned military professional. He has said that he's on the record as saying, look, if NATO hadn't been created, we'd have to create it. You know, if we didn't have NATO, we'd have to build a NATO. He understands this. So there is going to be, I think, a serious battle in the ranks of the Trump administration once it gets down to serious things like whether or not we maintain the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, whether we start billing the Japanese in a kind of humiliating way for the 80-plus bases that we maintain in their country, whether we start demanding the NATO countries increase their defense budgets as a condition of maintaining our commitment to NATO. These are things that are going to, you know, come to the fore very, very quickly. And I think there's going to be a serious battle in the ranks of the administration between military professionals that understand the importance of alliances and the more ideologically inclined members of the Trump administration, the more populist, the more nationalist, people like Steve Bannon, Trump himself. So we'll see how it plays out. But it's clear, I'd have to agree with the German foreign minister, you know, it's pretty clear that the world the United States has built and maintained for 70 years is coming to an end. And, you know, when empires pass, we do two things. You look at their excesses, and there's no question the American empire, like every empire, has had its excesses. The Vietnam War, the 2003 Iraq invasion, the Abu Ghraib torture and prison scandal, then there's no question that this empire has had its successes. But, you know, as it passes, let's just pause and note that it's also had its achievements. We've had 70 years of relative peace. We've had a global economy that's, by every account, has reduced world poverty quite considerably. The number of people leaving, you know, the poorest of the world's poor every day increases enormously through this global economy. We've created strong multilateral organizations. The United Nations is very strong. The World Trade Organization, you can criticize, but nonetheless, it provides a certain kind of economic. It's strong. There are all kinds of bilateral pacts. The European Union has grown and prospered under NATO's protective shield. One could go on and on. It's been a very good 70 years in the history of the world, certainly compared to the half century that preceded us, the carnage of World War I and the extraordinary carnage of World War II. And so it's like all world orders. It's also not only powerful and got real continuity to it, but it's also very fragile and very delicate. And it doesn't take much to unravel it. And that's what we're watching right now. We're watching a potential unraveling of the world order that's existed for the past 70 years.
But to what end, though? I mean, look, I'm not a great fan of empire, and I've always been concerned that the American empire may well destroy the republic. And obviously we spend far too much on defense. But on the other hand, I'm not that excited about a world where China is the hegemon, or even worse, where Russia's Putin and a bunch of gangster states under his control run the world. I mean, you know, people have to keep two thoughts in their head at the same time. Maybe we have too much empire, but on the other hand, if the Americans just unilaterally withdraw from the world, what's going to replace them?
Another form of empire, another form of global hegemony, whether it's a single superpower like the United States or a bunch of regional hegemons as Russia and China are proposing, but there will be some supranational world order, okay, of differential power, more powerful, less powerful nations. You know, we've had empires in the history of the world for 4,000 years. It doesn't look like this is a moment at which we're moving beyond empire to global governance via the UN. We're moving to a situation of alternative empires, regional hegemons. And let's remember another key aspect that accompanied the U.S. rise to global power. From the time the United Nations emerged on the world stage in 1907 at the Second Hague International Peace Conference, the United States has been a consistent, although recently a rather uneven, advocate of the idea of the international rule of law, of taking the whole kind of fabric of courts and constitution and laws that knits this vast and complex society together and carrying that onto the international stage. And we've been quite successful in doing that. At the end of World War II, instead of shooting our enemies, we had two international military tribunals. We established the Nuremberg Code of Medical Ethics. We established that we were prime movers in the Geneva Conventions for the treatment of prisoners. And we pushed the whole idea of the international rule of law. Well, both Russia and China seem to have very little respect for that kind of rule of law. This has been one of the artifacts of American power. It's been, it's always been, of course, very uneven. The lesser powers have to obey it more than the United States, which can be, kind of self-referential in the way that it imposes the law on itself. But more or less, we've kind of followed it. Well, the succeeding world order by Russia and China has no commitment to this fabric of international law, which has taken a century to really develop. And I think that's something we're really going to miss. And we see that, in what's playing out in the South China Sea recently. Last year, the Court of Arbitration in The Hague ruled in the favor of a very weak nation, the Philippines, which doesn't have a single operating jet fighter, versus the massive emerging global power, China, saying that Scarborough Reef and those other islands in the South China Sea, they gave, even though China can build these artificial islands, it gave them no status as territorial claims, and they ruled resolutely in the favor of the Philippines. China just waved it away, just completely ignored that international decision, and has used its power with the current Philippine government to get that government to back away from this decision as well. So we're seeing the emerging global hegemon, China, repudiating not only that particular decision, but the entire rule of law that has been built up very painfully over the span of 100 years, two world wars. There's a lot of blood that was spilled to build that, and it's too bad that it's going to pass away, potentially, in this new world order.
Well, but it'll pass away for apparently incoherent, inconsistent, almost invisible reasons. I mean, if I knew what Trump and Bannon were thinking here, it'd be one thing. Obviously, empires come and go. It takes a while. But the idea to unilaterally shoot yourself in the foot, we know that Putin wanted this guy elected, I think, more than anything, to weaken America. And it looks as though Trump is going to oblige. He's going to rip up NATO, encourage the breakup of Europe, and allow China to take over the Pacific.
Yeah, but one of the things I think, your question provokes a reply, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons that America can have a new administration that will almost willfully, and it's kind of almost an act of, you might say, blind ignorance, begin to demolish the key components of its architecture of global power, is that the United States has always been the empire that dare not utter the name. We've always done two things, amassed ever-increasing amounts of global power and denied that we are an empire, that we are a hegemon, that we have a system. Unlike Great Britain, which talked about the British Empire, capital B, capital E, endlessly, had maps about it, taught about it, debated it, discussed it, and understood it very clearly what it was and managed it very skillfully. Small island nation in control of about a quarter of the world's population, even its peak about half the world's population. This required a real consensus among the British elite to make that system work. Well, during the Cold War, America could never admit that it was an empire. The Soviet Union called us imperialists. They were the ones with the evil empire. We would have no such thing. So we've been an empire that's never really understood the apparatus of global power, its nature, its strengths, its weaknesses. Some people, sure, that operate it understand it. But there's really a very poor public understanding of it. And so we can elect a president who, like many, many people, doesn't understand the apparatus of power that he's supposed to wield, to operate. And that contradiction between this extreme nationalism, this America first, this denial of America's global presence, of American hegemony, American imperial power, this is manifest, I think, in the Trump administration's lack of understanding of what they need to do in order to maintain American power and world order.
Well, if you think the American empire was bad, wait till you are ruled by the Chinese empire, and God help you if you're ruled by the Russian empire. So choose your poison, right? Okay, Al, well, you've depressed the hell out of me. I thank you for joining you.
Ian, it's been a pleasure.
Again, let me remind the audience that I've been speaking with Albert McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, and America's Decline, and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. His latest book, coming out soon, is very relevant to the conversation we just had, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the subtext in today's hearings to confirm the new head of the CIA.
Empire, the newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triad, an articulate liar.
Every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, who's the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security, and has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy, and his new book is The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Thank you, Ian. Very good to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Locke. And the confirmation hearings today of Representative Mike Pompeo, the Republican congressman from Kansas, he was basically The Democrats have been trying to have more time to interview him. They feel the confirmation being rushed. On the other hand, the White House and the Republicans are saying that the Democrats are holding it up. But a lot of people I've talked to in the intelligence community say what's really going on here is that the Trump administration want Pompeo in at the CIA because they want to stop this counterintelligence investigation into Trump's campaign's possible ties to the Kremlin. So is there a subtext to this battle between whether or not to have more hearings with Pompeo and less? Because at this point, it does look like he's going to be confirmed.
I think really the main reason that things have gone slower than the administration would like on the Senate Intelligence Committee confirmation hearings is simply that the men and women on that committee don't want to be pushed around. They have their procedures, and they don't want to rush through it. These decisions should not be made in haste. There needs to be thorough questioning. But as for the hypothesis that the reason it's gone so slow is because the Trump people are afraid that there'll be an investigation about the whole Russian business, doesn't strike me as being very sensible, because that's going forward anyway. That genie's out of the bottle, and there's no way to put it back in. So there will be a Senate and probably a House investigation. There might even be, as John McCain is calling for, a special select committee that looks into this, but there's no way to stop that inquiry.
So you don't think that you could have a situation where, like Dick Cheney went over to the CIA and essentially intimidated them into some form of submission, into signing off on the Iraq war? The only dissent came from INR and from the Department of Energy. But by and large, it looks as though the Bush administration were able to buffalo the Intelligence Committee into going along with the Iraq war, which, of course, in retrospect, was a catastrophe. So what's your reading on the extent to which an executive branch can intimidate the intelligence community and bring them to heel?
I really think it's difficult to do. In fact, I don't even agree with the notion that Cheney was able to do it. I've been out to the CIA a number of times for research interviews, and I actually spoke to a number of the people that Cheney went out and tried to browbeat, and they said that they were thrilled to have a vice president, and they'd love to have a president come out because it's such a rare thing. They like the opportunity to talk to these people. But these are grown-ups. They've been in the business for years, and they're dedicated, almost all of them, to fact-finding, and they're not easily browbeaten by a vice president or even a president, for that matter. I think the reason we got things wrong about Iraq is because virtually everyone, including all the academic experts across the land and certainly the people in the intelligence community, with the exception, as you say, of INR and the State Department and the Energy Department, I would add to that list U.S. Air Force intelligence, but all the other intelligence agencies, including the muscular ones like CIA, NSA, DIA, all thought, genuinely so, that there were probably WMDs in Iraq. So I don't think that was a matter of browbeating. Now, can Trump and his people browbeat intelligence offices? They may try. In fact, they probably will try. But I don't think they'll have much success. And, of course, even though I find leaking of information abhorrent, and when I was in the government, I promise you I never did that, but it does happen, and the CIA knows how to play that game. And if there's browbeating going on, they'll simply contact some of their friends out in the world of media and get their viewpoint known and criticize the attempts at intimidation.
Now, of course, the ethos, if you will, in intelligence is often reduced down to the phrase to speak truth to power.
Yes.
And I recall, for example, during the Vietnam War, the CIA analyst Sam Adams essentially took on the entire power of the Pentagon, who had their version of reality in Vietnam, which was definitely not in line with Sam Adams' predictions.
Yes.
Though the U.S. was losing the war, while every day we had the so-called 5 o'clock follies news press conference where we were told we were winning and we were given given the body count, etc. So that has always been an assumption. Is that ethos alive and well, do you think? Because this is a difficult task to speak truth to power when the person in power at the apex of the intelligence pyramid, Donald Trump, has his own ideas of what is true. In fact, his own people just said that they can deal in alternative truths.
Yes. Well, that's very true, and you sum it up well. I would point out, back in the Vietnam era, that even Richard Helms, who was, after all, the top individual in the intelligence community and also the director of the CIA, kept telling Johnson, the President Lyndon Baines Johnson, time and time again in the Oval Office, that he was going to lose the war, and here are the reasons why. So there were people who were dissenting against the Pentagon view, and often I have a problem with Pentagon intelligence, the NSA and the Defense Intelligence Agency and so on, because they tend to take on the coloration of the politics of the Department of Defense. I think one of the virtues of the Central Intelligence Agency is that it's the only standalone organization among these 17, and it really, I think, is free of the coloration of departmental politics. So I think the ethos is pretty strong, certainly out at the CIA, but also in places like the, as you mentioned, INR, which is the State Department Intelligence Agency. These people, Ian, I know you are very dedicated to the truth, and you do your best to lay the facts out and present all sides of an issue. And I think that's the professional ethos of, you know, 99% of intelligence officers, too. It's certainly at the CIA. Sometimes that doesn't entirely work out in the Defense Intelligence Agencies, where they're under the pressure of serving for the Secretary of Defense. But even then, most of the time, I think they try and put the facts on the table. I had a wonderful chat, by the way, with Richard Helms before he passed away, and he said, you know, there are policy wonks galore in the Oval Office and other high meeting places in Washington. What you've got to have in the room is someone who's completely dedicated to the facts. And that's where the CIA director comes in, or the director of national intelligence. And just quickly, Ian, let me say that I'm rather appalled that both the CIA director and the director of national intelligence are political appointees. These are people who have been in the Congress, and you know, politics and intelligence are not supposed to mix. It's like oil and water.
Well, we've already had Mike Pompeo, in effect, led the inquiry into Benghazi that was not an intelligence matter. It was a political matter.
Exactly.
There was no
exactly. And, you know, even his Tea Party colleagues were quite shocked that he went so far in attacking Hillary Clinton.
Right. And in his first round of confirmations, he said that he didn't necessarily believe in global warming, which would be, in the real world, perhaps the biggest challenge that the intelligence community faces, as there are massive dislocations of populations if global warming continues as scientists predicts. And in fact, you know, my sense is that within the other intelligence services around the world, for example, in Australia, that's the top of their top priority because...
Yes. Well, I think you're right. And, you know, we have to rely on some of our intelligence professionals to publicly resign if they're being pushed to color their findings or to, as they say, politicize intelligence. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough of that during the build-up to the war in Iraq. There should have been some people out at the CIA and the NSA and elsewhere who said, wait a minute, we don't think there are WMDs in Iraq. Let's wait about 6 months or so, go over there with another UN team and really find out if that hypothesis is true or not. But unfortunately, we didn't have people resigning, as opposed to the Vietnam War, where we had a number of people in the Foreign Service, young, particularly young, but mid-career diplomats who were resigning in protest because the Johnson and the Nixon administration were lying about that war.
Well, in terms of the rest of Mike Pompeo's testimony today, he seemed to be not entirely sure about waterboarding, whether it was a bad idea. And also, he was a little uncertain as well on disavowing mass surveillance. So,
yes.
Again, you know, this is a political person. He's a Tea Party Republican congressman. He did graduate from West Point at the top of his class. Served in the military during the Cold War, and now, as you mentioned, former Indiana Senator Coates is now the DNI, another political appointee. Just in the last couple of minutes, what is the possibility then? We talked about whether or not you could stop this inquiry that's ongoing into whether or not there was a connection, a collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Apparently, some of the evidence comes from the Baltic states, from intercepts. And also, I understand that there was a FISA warrant issued in October that named Manafort, Stone, and Carter Page. But there's also some reports that it may even have named Donald Trump. So you're confident that this stuff is on such a level, if it's all true, And we certainly know, because the intelligence community have said, in effect, they've come to a consensus that Russia did meddle in the elections yes. and that this was directed by Putin himself. So that much has been established. What about a conclusion here?
I do think that the Senate Intelligence Committee will go forward with an investigation. Now, if it turns out, as happened during the torture inquiry, that the Republicans on that committee sat on their hands and eventually voted against the report, the Democrats will go forward anyway. And the Democrats, as you know, produced a very fine report on the whole subject of torture. Unfortunately, the full report has been bottled up in the executive branch. Not even President Obama was willing to release it, which is too bad because that report could be released by sanitizing the sources and methods aspects so the American people would have the full story about torture. And what we're really relying on here, Ian, and this is what James Madison would have recommended, and it's part of our Constitution, we're relying on the Congress to fulfill its role to keep a close eye on the executive branch. And I expect not only an inquiry in the Senate committee, intelligence committee, but probably one in the House. And it wouldn't surprise me. In fact, I would strongly urge the Congress to create a special committee to look in this, not only related to what the ties are possibly between Trump and the Russians, but the whole broad question of what has been the state of Russian manipulation into the American political system. And I think that's going to happen because I think we're all outraged that the Russians did that.
Well, just in closing, though, what I find extraordinary, Locke Johnson, is that Donald Trump today tore up the TPP, which was largely a geostrategic, it wasn't so much a trade pact, but it was a geostrategic effort to contain China and to organize a neighborhood that alarmed by China's power, and in effect to force China to play by the very rules that Donald Trump complains that they don't play by. And now China's got a clear field. Their alternative trade pact is the only game in town, and all these countries that would have been in the TPP will join with China. So he's unilaterally shot America in the foot and weakened America in the Asia-Pacific region. And
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more with you.
But on the other side, in Europe, he's weakening NATO by trashing it and talking about it being obsolete. And he's also, because of his support for Brexit and his closeness to Nigel Farage, he's also, in effect, encouraging the breakup of Europe and the end of the EU. So if NATO goes, the EU breaks up, and the TPP is already gone, then what Trump has done already, for whatever reasons, and I don't know what they are, has weakened America enormously.
Well, I agree with you 100%, and it's amateur hour in the Oval Office, unfortunately, and we're going to have to depend on the people on Capitol Hill who are professionals and have lived through the Cold War and understand the decisions that have to be made with respect to our adversaries overseas. And we've got to rely on, I think the Secretary of Defense has been appointed is sensible, and I'm not even completely opposed to the new Secretary of State because I know people who know him and he seems to be a sensible person too. So we're going to have to rely on people to put sharp checks on our president and educate him.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure. Nice talking with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, who is the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversights Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security and has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy. And his latest book is The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether Saturday's massive demonstrations against Trump could evolve into a Tea Party of the left.
Afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you Everybody look what's going, never stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going, never stop.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University and the author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed the Nation, and Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and The Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-edits Dissent magazine, and his latest book is War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Trump's Civil Religion Has an Angry God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kazin.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of your foreign policy piece about Trump being the 45th president of the United States, isn't the first populist to be inaugurated, but he's the loneliness. It certainly is starting to feel that way. I mean, you wonder why it is that millions of Americans who'd voted for 9 million, in fact, had voted for Barack Obama, simply didn't show up and vote. About a million of whom were African Americans. And it's almost like on the weekend, the day after the inauguration, millions of Americans woke up, and I don't know how many of them didn't vote. But there's a recognition that you have a minority president who has an aggressive legislative agenda and is sort of petulantly, you know, striking out against the majority with these crazy tweets and press conferences or announcements by his press secretary in a way that is mind-boggling. So he's already on the defensive while enacting an aggressive agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Have we ever seen anything like that?
Not quite. I mean, I think, as you mentioned, a lot of people thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, if narrowly, and they weren't so crazy about her, and they just assumed she'd win, and things wouldn't change that much, and didn't bother to vote. There wasn't much enthusiasm for her, of course, and there was more enthusiasm among some of the people who voted for Trump, I think. But I wrote this piece. I was asked to write this piece to evaluate his inauguration speech, and what's interesting, I think, is that his inauguration speech was really just a sort of a compilation of his greatest hits from his campaign speeches, and that's quite surprising, because usually inauguration speech is it's part of our civil religion. It's part of sort of bringing the country together and talking about the Constitution and praising presidents in the past and saying you're going to be governing in the great tradition. And in some ways you can say that's there's a kind of phoniness in that, perhaps, but at least it continues the sense of we are all Americans together and we share something and we should work together towards a common goal. Whereas Trump made very clear we're not working together towards a common goal. Everybody in power now is corrupt, he didn't say exactly who those people were, but it's pretty clear they were the people sitting all around him, including former President Obama, of course, and other former presidents. And, he's, as you say, he's got a very aggressive agenda, but it's not clear that he really has the political skills to carry it off.
So already, though, out of the gate today, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, has been torn up. That was a campaign promise. Mm-hmm. But what I find fascinating about it was that it was really, the TPP was really more a political geostrategic containment of China in terms of organizing the neighborhood in trade to force China to play by the rules, the very arguments that Trump puts forth, that China doesn't play by the rules. Now, of course, China's got a free hand, and the Japanese and the other South Koreans and possibly the Australians will join in China's alternative to the TPP. And then on the other side of in Europe, you've got the possibility that, you know, Trump already supported Brexit. Brexit could unwind the EU, which will weaken Europe and strengthen Putin's hand. And, of course, Trump is already talking about breaking up NATO or abandoning NATO, which, of course, will play into Putin's hand. So the amazing thing about Trump, at least in terms of foreign policy, is the extent to which he's going to weaken America in an extraordinarily unilateral way and do so very quickly. And it's just breathtaking.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a very perilous time, I think. In some ways, we're sort of at the end of an era, some people call neoliberalism or globalism, where we're one assumed that trade agreements would go through. One assumed that a rising tide would lift all boats of the trade and of globalized industry. But also, it's also a crisis for the left. The tendency in politics I find myself part of, which is that social democrats, the more sort of reasonable left, reformist left, which has made so many important changes in Europe, especially in Australia, and to some degree in this country as well, in the name of liberalism, is also in terrible crisis because social democrats, liberals don't have a very sort of credible analyses of what went wrong, and they're also seen as having failed. So it's not surprising, perhaps, that you have Trumps, you have Le Pen, you have the anti-Brexit people in Britain, in both the Tory Party and the other smaller parties, and also analogs in Germany and Austria and even Scandinavia, because I think we're in a period where there's no consensus either among elites or, even more importantly, among ordinary voters about what path forward makes sense. And that's a dangerous situation.
But when you talk about confusion on the left, it is extraordinary, though, to see the left that used to stand up for human rights, in particular in El Salvador and in Nicaragua during the 1980s, is now making excuses for a capitalist thug, Vladimir Putin, in Moscow. And I understand why people on the left are leery of the American empire and concerned that the empire is going to bankrupt the republic, which is an enduring concern. But the idea to turn a blind eye to a dictator who's just meddled in our elections in order to get this right-wing populist idiot elected, who's just going to completely weaken America, which was obviously Putin's plan all along, that is unprecedented, surely.
I agree, but I think, with all respect, I think you're a little mistaken that the whole left is supporting Putin. Certainly my magazine is not Dissent, and the Republic is not. And one can, I think you have a certain group of people, Glenn Greenwald, some other people who are very, supportive of and help to advance the Snowden revelations. And The Nation magazine, especially because Steve Cohen, who's a Russian historian, very pro-Putin in many ways, is married to Katrina VanHeuvel, who edits The Nation. But I think it's a minority of people on the left, really, who are saying these things. And I think they're saying them because they take their anti-imperialism, and I should say their anti-U.S. imperialism, too far. Like used to be said about the Bourbons of the Ancien Regime in France, they've learned nothing and forgotten nothing. For them, anything that anybody in the American elite believes must be wrong. And so if the American elite, and that includes the New York Times, of course, Washington Post, and the CIA say that Putin tried to throw the election to Trump, help throw the election to Trump, perhaps, then this must be, yet another elite attempt to start tension with Russia and perhaps get more control over Europe. So I think there's a real split on the left, is what I'm saying. I think a majority of people who consider themselves to be on the left are not supportive of Putin, and certainly not supportive of Trump.
Well, I think maybe, Michael, it's to do with the fact that I'm at Pacifica Radio and surrounded by the very people that you're talking about.
Well, that's possible. I wouldn't. besides your wonderful show, I don't listen to Pacifica very much.
Yeah. So.
But I do talk to a lot of people, around the country and the world who consider themselves to be on the left, and then there's a general feeling that Putin is a bad guy.
Right. Well, let's then talk a little bit about your new book, War Against
Great.
War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. And let's start with the fact that massive demonstrations across the political spectrum took place back during World War I to keep America out of that war. And these were peace demonstrations. And how would that relate to what we just saw on Saturday, this spontaneous outpouring of millions of women across the country? It's as though we're in a moment now where you have political energy on the left in search of a strategy?
No, that's a very good question. I think one of the things that the movement, really coalition against World War I in this country, shows that if you want to make any headway, and I think they almost actually helped stop the U.S. from entering the war, though, of course, in the end, they failed. But you have to have an inside-outside strategy. You know, you have to do the kind of things that very inspiring marches. I was on it Saturday here in D.C., and, of course, there's a huge march in L.A. and marches in different cities around the country. You've got to have those marches. You've got to show the power of, you know, people in the streets of a social movement. But at the same time, you also have to realize that if you're going to change the politics of the government, you have to get in the government. You have to have people, have to allies in the government. And that means, though some folks at Pacifica perhaps won't like it, it means you have to elect Democrats, you know. You have to have some access to state power. And so I think this is, by the way, what the anti-war movement did in during World War One. They had a lot of people in Congress supporting them. A very strict, you know, in some ways a ideologically diverse coalition of Southern Democrats and Midwestern Republicans like Robert La Follette, the great senator from Wisconsin. But they also had anarchists like Emma Goldman. They had the whole Socialist Party at the time, which was a pretty large party. So they were able to muster strength both on the streets, so to speak, and in Congress. And that really helped stop the U.S. from building up the army, as many people like Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and sometimes Woodrow Wilson wanted to do. In the end, they were not successful in stopping the U.S. from entering the war because the Germans decided to start torpedoing neutral ships again in early 1917. They stopped for a while. And also Wilson wanted to try to influence the how the war would come out. He thought he'd be able to influence the peace if the U.S. helped to win the war for the Allies. And that ended up being a failed hope. I think it's important for any movement, especially the one now, which is going to try to stop Trump and hopefully defeat him in 4 years, to understand you can't just be outside the halls of power. You've got to influence who gets in to power as well.
Well, you know, there's talk of forming a kind of Tea Party on the left in terms of how the Tea Party became the tail that wagged the dog of the Republican Party. It was a sort of spontaneous movement that exploded on the scene a few years back in a way similar to what just seems to be happening now. What's your sense of where populism on the left is compared to populism on the right, if indeed Donald Trump is a product of populism on the right in the sense of he was propelled into office? My sense is that it was a little more confusing than that, because in the very key states that Trump won, that the Democrats should have won, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, a lot of white union voters who would normally vote Democrat voted for Trump.
No, it's true. And, you know, the problem with economic populism for the left, which I think definitely people on the left have to express that kind of politics. It's the only way of having a multiracial movement, a movement, a multi-class movement, I think, is about economic grievances. As Bernie Sanders, I think, showed to the extent he was able to do that, that was successful. On the other hand, you know, the left is a more diverse group than the right, demographically, as we know. And you can't just tell people, obviously, whose real cause is Black Lives Matter, or whose real cause is LGBT rights, or whose real cause is immigrant rights, that they should subsume their demands, their really deeply felt demands from within the communities for this larger cause. I think we need sort of a combination, I guess, of coalitions of people who agree to put some of those emphases, you know, to the side at least for a while, or believe that really the main way to defeat Trump is to show what a fraud he is about economic issues, that he's not really going to help white workers who voted for him. But you know, it's going to be tough, because you know, I think we've seen in the streets that, you know, you had a women's march, which was very important, and of course probably the largest women's march in history. But the very fact it's called a women's march, that's something the right would never call their huge marches a women's march. They would always talk about it being the march of the people or taxpayers or something like that. So, you know, I think the success of the left in organizing these communities around their specific grievances and demands and visions is also a weakness, you know, because the left contains multitudes, and those multitudes at some point have to agree on, you know, a very small set of demands that they want to push in order to help win back the country.
Well, already former Secretary of State Kerry, in speaking in Davos, suggested that Donald Trump may be impeached soon. So, you know, if that's...
I think that's unlikely myself.
Yeah, I agree that it's perhaps...
If the Congress was controlled by Democrats, it might be possible, but
yeah.
Controlled by Republicans.
No, it seems like wishful thinking. But I don't think it's a particularly helpful thing, in the sense that my sense is, when you mentioned that the people that voted for Donald Trump have to figure out eventually that they've been had, that he's not out for their interests, the working class people, even though he said so in his inauguration speech, his cabinet of billionaires speaks louder, I think. His actions speak louder. So if indeed he is the fraud that I suspect he is, the people have to learn the hard way. And of course, the problem is, we're all collateral damage in that. But to my mind, the people who voted for him have to be disabused of who he really is, because if there's an impeachment or any other way to get rid of him prior to that, then those people will think that he's a martyr and that he could have made America great again, but the establishment struck back.
Yeah, it's possible. And we have to remember that a lot of people who voted for him, his victory margin in these three states you mentioned, Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, probably came from people who voted for Obama last time, at least a lot of them did, and certainly voted for Obama in 2008. So, you know, I think people on the left make the mistake of thinking that everybody or the large majority of people who voted for Trump, and certainly those who put him over the top, are just completely true believers and loyalists to Trump. You know, most Americans who actually make the difference in the election, or are not strong partisans of one party or the other, don't tend to take their vote quite as seriously as partisans often do. And I think the FBI, thinking about the emails which came out just 11 days before the election, might have made a difference there. If, as you say, if more African Americans had been excited voting for Hillary, that would have made a difference. More people coming out to vote in Milwaukee and Philadelphia. So we have to remember people who oppose almost everything Trump wants to do, that he won very narrowly. It was a very near thing, and so people should not sort of take his election as a sign that America changed, you know, fundamentally on November 8th of last year.
Well, Michael Kazin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Kazin, who's a professor of history at Georgetown University and the author of The Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-edits Dissent magazine, and his latest book is War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Trump's Civil Religion Has an Angry God. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.